This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, curing diabetes in mice and treating depression. But first up, bird flu. It's back in the news this week. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced that the H5N1 virus has evolved into two distinct strains, which makes some officials nervous that the disease could be moving closer to becoming infectious between humans. Separately, the World Health Organization announced that the human death toll has passed the 100 mark, though the virus has not acquired the ability to spread easily from person to person. Insight into why it doesn't spread easily is making news also. Two different teams of scientists think they know why. Their studies appeared in this week in Nature and Science and detail what makes this disease different from human flu viruses that we normally spread from one to another. What does this mean also about the possibility of a pandemic in humans? What does it mean for the government and for all governments trying to prepare for a pandemic? That's what we'll be talking about first up this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Nicholas Wade is a science reporter at the New York Times here in New York. He joins us by phone from his office. So welcome back to the program, Nick.
Thank you, Ira.
You wrote about this story this week. Can you tell us about the why these viruses, it appears, are not so easy to spread among people?
Well, it turns out that they the avian form of the virus prefers a particular kind of cell receptor, and this kind of receptor and the cells that carry it happen to be distributed right at the bottom of the human lung. So this means that the usual way that the flu virus is spread, which is by coughs and sneezes, doesn't work for the avian flu virus, at least the H5N1, that's the current bird flu around, whereas human flu viruses colonize the upper airways, the trachea. So when you cough, you spread them out, and that's why it's so easily transmissible.
Huh. Well, what is there about the bottom of the lung where it can get to and survive, and the top of the lung?
Well, it just seems to be that different cell types inhabit those two areas of the lung, and they carry on their surface different kinds of receptor. The receptor is the sort of particular a protein that the virus looks for when it gains entry to the cell. So it just so happens that these cells that a particular kind of receptor, which the avian flu virus likes, and which is widespread in the intestines of birds, the virus's usual host, happens also to be used by the human cells that live in the bottom part of the lung. Mm-hmm. So that's where the cell resides when it infects people. But it just sort of sits down there, and it's very hard to get it out by coughs and sneezes, and that seems to be the reason why the virus spreads hardly, if at all, from one person to another. You have to catch it directly from birds. And as long as it stays that way, we're not going to get a pandemic, not from this virus anyway.
Yeah, and that is the question. Will it stay that way, and how long?
Right. It's a very hard one to answer, and this is where virologists differ, although they all agree that we will be getting a pandemic sooner or later. They differ as to whether this particular virus, the avian H5 type, is the one that will be the pandemic. Now, some say that it's been around for so long, about 20 years now, without becoming a pandemic in the human population, that it seems pretty unlikely it will ever do so. On the other hand, there was a paper in Science last week, separate from the one you mentioned this week, and that was by scientists at Scripps who were trying to figure out how many mutations it would take to give the H5 virus the ability to switch its preference for cell receptors, i.e. to switch from the type down in the bottom of our lung to the type in the upper airways. And they figured it would only take two mutations. And since viruses mutate pretty fast all the time, two mutations is not such a big hurdle.
Have they been trying out these things in laboratories to see how many mutations it would take?
Yeah, they know from looking at the three viruses that caused the three pandemics of the 20th century, the 1918 flu, the Asian flu, and the Hong Kong flu. They've analyzed those viruses very closely, and in particular, they've analyzed one particular gene. It's called the hemagglutinin gene, which is very important because this is what the virus uses as its probe to latch onto these receptors. So this is the sort of working end of the virus. And they find that all these three viruses started out as bird flus. Wild birds seem to be the main reservoir of the virus in the animal kingdom. So the H1, both the H1 and the H2 and the H3 hemagglutinin genes, they all required just two mutations to switch from the bottom of the lung receptor to the top of the lung type receptor.
Right. Right. There are two strains of H5N1 have been identified. I mentioned it before. Well, what does this mean? Does it mean that there are more strains that we have to worry about, or is that good news?
I think, as far as you can tell, it's kind of sort of neutral news right now. I mean, it just means, and because the virus mutates so fast, and since it's globally spread now, it's sort of populations in two parts of the world, in sort of East Asia and in Indonesia, have sort of diverged slightly. It doesn't seem to be any sort of big deal. It may complexify the task of making a vaccine against it if we have to do that. In other words, we may need vaccines against both sort of strains or subtypes instead of just one. But that seems to be the extent of it.
What does this mean, this news about the difficulty of transmission from person to person? Does this give comfort, do you think, to governments who are planning for a pandemic to know that it's a little more, you know, difficult to spread? Does it buy them any time in planning?
Well, one of the scientists whose report came out this week, that's Yoshihiro Kawaoka at the University of Wisconsin. He said explicitly, or rather he said in a press release put out by his university, which he approved, he didn't say it himself directly, he said, yes, indeed, that this will give us more time. And I think that was based on his implicit view that H5 is probably not the strain that's going to give us the pandemic. And several other virologists also believe that. And even though it seems just two mutational steps away from being able to become highly transmissible, at least if you look at the hemagglutinin gene, most virologists think there must be many other changes it needs to make before it becomes a fully transmissible human pandemic-type flu virus. They don't know what those changes are, but it just seems that the virus needs to alter not just the hemagglutinin gene, but several of the other of its 11 genes before it can become really successful. Mm. So I think it's that kind of thinking that has led Kawaoka and others to say, well, maybe we can be a bit more relaxed about this. They're not saying it in so many words because none of them wishes the government to relax its effort to get better prepared.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, there are 16 strains of viruses in animals out there. It could come from any one of those.
Well, that's right. But I guess one has to also keep in mind, you know, scary as the situation may be, that these 16 strains have been around for a long time.
Yeah.
And although, of course, we don't know about sort of pandemics in sort of past history, you know, before the 20th century, nonetheless, at least in the 20th century, only three of them ever made it across. I mean, right. It must be very difficult for viruses to switch hosts. This is one of the points Kawaoka made, that quite often they do switch hosts just for a short time, but then most of these transfers fail to take the next step, i.e. of starting a sort of chain of transmission. Mm-hmm. They tend to sort of peter out very quickly. So if most of these transfers are dead ends, then it follows that if you look at any particular one, such as the H5 avian flu we have now, that the chances are that it is a dead end.
Mm-hmm. Is there a time that when the flu season will be over this year, when we could stop worrying about the flu being transmitted, or will it just keep going on, you know, even through the summer?
Well, my guess is it's a permanent worry. I'm not sure where it is in the southern hemisphere, but essentially it's a global threat. So I guess while we're getting out of doors more, the people in the southern hemisphere will be having their flu season. So I'm assuming that WHO will be sort of watching this round the clock.
Yeah, I can imagine. One last question, because I get this question asked all the time of me, and I'm hoping that you could answer it. Now, people want to know, is it safe to eat chicken? You know, I just was in France last week, and chicken is like the national food in France. It's hard to find it on a menu now.
Really? That's amazing.
Yeah, it's hard to find it on a menu.
There's so many threats against French civilization. But I think there's one to be safe about, because the virus is going to be pretty well cooked in most foods. And second, although birds, as I understand it, have this receptor in their intestines, we don't. So it seems very unlikely that you could get the flu from eating chicken, especially as it seems you need massive doses of this virus to get infected. And most of the people who've got infected, they sleep in the same room with chickens. So dose is important with viruses. And I think the infectious dose for avian flu virus is very high, and the chances of you getting an infectious dose in chicken that you've cooked and are digesting fast is very low.
So it's not the fact that the cooking kills the virus?
Well, I think that the cooking probably kills sort of most of the virus, but even the if any virus particles survive, they then have to cope with hydrochloric acid and the enzymes in the stomach, so they've got to do all that. And I guess these receptors, I'm guessing here, but I assume they're pretty rare in the human intestine. Yeah. Yeah. So they won't find any place they can gain entry into the intestinal cells.
Nick, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us, okay?
Oh, it's my pleasure. Good talking to you.
Thanks a lot. Nicholas Wade is a science reporter for The New York Times, and he was joining us from here in New York. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about diabetes research with Dr. Denise Faustman, who's regular on Science Friday, talking about some new and interesting turns of events in her laboratory. Stay with us. We'll be right back.